This is Amy, and you're listening to the Talkin' Appalachian Podcast.
I've talked before about my great-grandmother Ethel and how important she was to me, not just in my life, but in my career path and the way that I chose to study Appalachian studies and particularly dialect. I told you in an earlier episode that I collected her oral history for a project in undergraduate school, which I am forever grateful for, always grateful for that assignment, because it encouraged me to preserve her stories in her authentic voice. And I really think that was the pivotal point for me in terms of figuring out what I wanted to do. So I always love to listen back to interviews and to, you know, videos of my mama and her sisters getting together, because I just love to hear their voices. There's one video in particular that gave rise to a story that I wrote about, and I'm going to share it with you. When the sisters got together, and so when I mean her sisters, she had many brothers and sisters, but the ones that were still living when I was growing up were Eva, Emma, and Grace. And their children would bring them to Virginia to visit with my mama. And when the four of them got together, it was hilarious to listen to them tell their stories and to watch them laugh together. And it often made me sad that they didn't live closer, because they had such a good time when they were together. And it also makes me sad that, you know, we didn't have FaceTime then and Zoom. And I think they so would have enjoyed being able to see each other every day, although I don't know that they would have used it. My mama didn't care much for technology, but I think they would have, just to be able to see each other. My cousin Junior had a video camera back in the 80s that he took everywhere. And one time when the sisters got together, he videoed them sitting around the kitchen table telling stories. And I watched that video a couple of years ago, and it reminded me of this really terrible story that Mama would tell me about the time that her aunt almost murdered her mother. It wasn't uncommon to hear really gory or scary stories from the older folks, because, you know, some really crazy stuff happened back in the old days. But this story in particular was disturbing, because they saw this happen when they were children, and it was their mother. And so you can imagine how traumatic that would have been to see that happen. And I thought over the years about the woman who had the knife and what was going on, what caused that, and so really without a whole lot more detail, I sat down and wrote an essay, and this is just sort of an imagining of how all of this unfolded based on the details that I heard from the sisters, keeping in mind that mental illness was definitely a factor here, and that there weren't a lot of resources for someone who suffered from that. And so I want to share this little essay with you. I haven't published it. I did win a little essay contest a few years ago, which was fun. It was at the Mountain Heritage Literary Festival. And I'm a writer at heart, and I love to work with words. And I think this is as close to the truth as I could get while imagining what this must have looked like. So I hope you enjoy. Violence crawled into the hollers of Appalachia in the early 20th century and perched on the tallest hills. If it took form, it might have looked like gargoyles with wide, evil grins and pointed wings. It slithered in the creeks and hovered in the air to poison the melody of church choirs. It floated in a man's moonshine and covered his brain in cobwebs. Sometimes it got to the women. Maybe it was the hard living that made people mean, or the homemade liquor that flowed from those moonshine stills. My great-grandfather, Elkanah Stanley, hunted in the thickets of rhododendron and the mouths of caves. When he found a still, he took the whole thing home and stored them in the attic, where they were heaped like dead spiders. "If I'm gone and a man comes by looking for his still," he told his girls, "let him in to get it." No still was worth a life, but if someone hurt his wife or one of his girls, Elkanah would have tracked and killed that person, lawman or not. He would have killed his sister-in-law, if not for 2 days that gave him time to come to his senses. In a grainy video filmed in the 1980s, her nieces, sisters, brought together by the children, told her story. Known as Aunt Pop, Polly Ann Ramsey was born in 1849 in Russell County, Virginia, the oldest of 13 children. In a picture of her taken in the 1920s or 30s, she stands with one hand on her hip in front of a ramshackle cabin, a bonnet pulled low over her eyes. By all accounts, she was a big woman with strong hands that itched for a blade and a block of wood. Though times were hard, children knew how to build castles and make money. The girls fashioned playhouses from logs and lined the ground and walls with thick green moss that they gathered in the hems of their dresses for wall-to-wall carpet. They counted out their money in leaves and left no bills unpaid, even with a depression bearing down. They made their fun because there was none to be bought. They would not have had the money for it anyway, which is why they were so fascinated with old Aunt Pop's wooden dolls. Family lore has cast Pop as a spinster who spent her days carving what the children thought were witchy-looking dolls that she stored out of the reach of tiny hands. The nieces and nephews stole glances at those dolls through dirty windows of a crowded room where she slept. The dolls glared from their shelf. No one knows why Pop made them. Maybe she was creating her own kind of strange companionship. Pop was reclusive and paranoid, known to keep her money hidden in a gallon bucket under the floorboards of her room. Sometimes she carried her money in rolls, bound up in the folds of her heavy skirts. Word spread that there was easy money to be found around that old woman, attracting robbers like wild dogs lured to a carcass by its odor. Two men hid and waited for her one day as she was walking. They overpowered her and cut the money rolls from her skirts before running away. The law caught up with them and sent one to jail for a year. Had she been carrying her knife that day, it wouldn't have mattered that the young robbers were her nephews. She would have carved them up like the wooden dolls she kept hidden from the children, who were right to be scared of her. Those two boys were just plain lucky fools because not long after that, she lost what was left of her mind and tried to kill her own sister. "That will stay with me as long as I live," said Emma, who was 10 years old when she saw her mother stabbed nearly to death. Of all their memories, the most vivid for Emma and Eva is that of their mother's blood pooling on the porch. The men were logging that day, and Alcana's wife, Nancy Jane, and their daughter Emma had gotten up early to walk to the logging site to cook for them. They met Pop at the bend of the road. Tensions were high in the family since the two boys stole Pop's money. Fathers quarreled about which boy put the other one up to it, and mothers took sides. Pop, with no husband and no children, was likely blamed for telling it to the law instead of the family, who could have dealt with the boys themselves. "Shouldn't have been carrying all that money on her, crazy old woman," it might have been said as hands reached for seconds around the dinner table. "Young men get ideas in their heads. They were wrong for stealing from family, but we'd have gotten it all back and made them wish they was in jail." Nancy Jane, well aware of her sister's strange turn, didn't like for Pop to be around the children when she wasn't there. So when Pop told her she was heading toward the house to fetch a pig that had gone astray, Nancy Jane planted herself between her sister and the house. "You turn round and go home," she said sharply. "Your old sow ain't out here." Maybe Pop heard a tone in her sister's voice that she didn't like, or maybe she heard, "You old sow." What's for certain is that Pop's knife was strapped to her wrist that day, hidden beneath her sleeve, and it came out before her sister knew what was happening. The first cut nearly killed Nancy Jane, missing her heart by inches. Pop pounced on her sister like a rabid cat, slicing at her back with muscled hands. Emma sprinted back to the house, screaming for her older sisters and brothers. Nancy Jane's sons heard the commotion and saw the two women struggling up the lane. They wrangled Pop from their mother and chased her straight into the thick, untamed woods, which swallowed her up. Before it ended, Pop had stabbed Nancy Jane 17 times, with two wounds in her chest and the rest on her back. The children carried their mother to the front porch where it seemed that she would bleed to death. Blood soaked her dress, snaked down her arms, and dripped from her fingers. It trickled down her legs and filled her shoes, spilling onto the planks of the porch, where it forever stained the wood and darkened the dust in the yard. It found a ditch and oozed like crimson oil. One of the boys rode straight to Clintwood for the nearest doctor as his mother lay pale and clinging to life. Another went for his daddy, who rode harder than he ever had back to the farm and stared helplessly at his wife while the older daughter struggled to plug the wounds, their hands fluttering over her body. He must have stood there for some time, watching her tremble from the chill that took hold. He clenched his jaw and in a low voice told one of his children to get him his hog rifle. Then he turned and set a determined path into the woods. Pop had disappeared to a place where she thought she'd never be found, but he would track her down. He knew all the hiding places from his work as a revenuer, the thickets, hollow trees, and caves that would cloak a man and his still long enough for one good run. After a couple of days, they found her, hiding in the cave like a wild animal. Elkanah raised his rifle, closed one eye, aimed between her eyes, and bid her good riddance. The men who had followed him moved in closer. They reminded him in low voices that he was the county revenuer. He still had youngins to feed, and how in the hell would Nanny and the kids live with her old man in the state penitentiary? Their words, and Elkanah's good sense, bought Pop another 20 years. They hauled her off to jail where they declared her insane, as Emma said in disbelief, and set her free because there was not much else to do with people like Pop except leave them to family. She lived until 1934 in a one-room log house down from the hill from the Ramsey home place and walked a wide circle around Elkanah Stanley and his brood. As strange as it seems now, family was family back then, which is why they didn't run her off like a stray dog. If you decide to let them live, you had to provide. Miraculously, Nancy Jane survived, but she would lose a battle with cancer a few years later. Her children must have had a few questions for the Almighty over that. A mother leaving her children so early, while the person who tried to kill her, someone they said was touched in the head, could live to be an old woman. Sometimes, justice is measured in long, lonely days with nothing but the frozen, witchy faces of dolls and an ugly legacy for company. I'm joined today by Dr. Angela Washington, also my cousin. We grew up together, visiting cousins. Would you please talk about your career with the Air Force and what you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse just a little over 30 years. I also am a flight nurse with the Air Force Reserve. So I love that career that I'm crazy about. I was out for several years from active duty when I was a brand new nurse. So probably about 8 years ago, I went back into the reserve. So I'm super excited to be able to pick up my career as I got an order. I have a PhD in nursing, and I currently teach as an adjunct faculty at Bellarmine University, which is one of our universities in Louisville. It's a Catholic university. Before that, I was 13 years at University of Louisville. And I'm also a nurse practitioner, and I work at our university hospital, which is our public hospital. And I love it as a hospitalist. So I love that. During my research for my PhD, I stayed focused on health, the history of healthcare for African Americans, particularly in the city of Louisville, but I looked at all matters of disparity, particularly where racism plagued our healthcare system. And that's kind of been where my interest has stayed for the most part. All my research is sort of towards that, which is, I love history. I fancy myself a historian. I don't know if I could claim that title yet, but I do love it. I love it. That's my favorite thing, is to be in old books, old papers, pictures.
Me too.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we reconnected. Your dad did a lot of documenting of our family history and has all of these wonderful videos and photographs. And your grandmother and my great-grandmother were sisters. So growing up, what I knew, you were my Indiana family.
Yes.
And I was your Lee County family. And so
we have more syllables in life than you do.
Yeah.
Do you remember the bicentennial? Can you remember that far back, the bicentennial year?
I don't remember it, but I have pictures of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I do, because it was the best year ever. I always laugh. I'm like, it was the best year ever because it was bicentennial. There was all this bicentennial stuff pretty much all summer long, which was so fun for as a kid. I thought it was the best thing. And that was the same year that Jimmy Carter won president, which was my first recollection of a presidential election. And I loved Jimmy Carter. Just loved him. It was like the best year ever in my memory. And I remember having the four sisters and doing that whole sort of colonial. Remember they made those dresses. Mm-hmm. And it was in the bonnets. And Aunt Emma made me a doll. And you probably got one too. And it was like a fabric doll. And I'm hoping my mom can find it because it was at the house somewhere, mom and dad's, but it had her name where she wrote down that she had made it in 1976.
The four sisters. So there was Emma, Eva, Grace, who was your grandmother, and I almost said Mamma, Ethel, who was my great grandmother. And there was this wonderful video of them sitting around the kitchen table telling stories. And they told the story of the time that their mother was almost murdered. And they witnessed it, and it was horrific. But when we were talking about, and you know, thinking about it as a child, it's like a ghost story. It's like a terrible, horrible,
creepy
story. It's creepy when you're a child. Looking back as an adult now, you know, we have a whole different perspective because of what we know about mental illness and things like that. And I don't know. Do you know if anything was ever documented about Polly mental health?
Not that I'm aware of, but, you know, I'm so grateful for the newspapers.com site because you can get access to so many things on there. So I may try to take a look and see if I can find anything about that. You know, anytime anybody did anything, stuff was documented, somebody had mental illness, they document it, which is kind of crazy now from today's HIPAA standards. But for instance, Elkanah, which is your grandmother, by the way, I always called her Aunt Buck. Mm-hmm. So I will probably reference her as Aunt Buck because that's how I knew her. Mm-hmm. And her name was Ethel, but she got that nickname, my understanding is, because she was so stubborn.
Yeah.
And so we always called her that. But their dad, Grandma and Aunt Buck's dad, ran for sheriff one year, Elkanah. And that's in the newspapers. I saw it in the old newspapers. And so that's kind of cool. So you can find little tidbits like that, which I love. So I'll see if I can find anything on her. My understanding is it was a pig. Apparently the pig had wandered up the mountainside there to be with a grandma's house or at the great grandmother's house. And Polly accused her of stealing it. I mean, you know, if you don't have the pig enclosed, I mean, it's going to go where it's going to go.
So that right there might indicate some paranoia.
Yes.
I mean, who knows? We can only speculate, but maybe
we can only speculate. Yeah. But as you brought out in your essay, like she was paranoid definitely of those children after those boys, after what happened to her.
Yeah.
And so you can see where, you know, she seemed very private and probably a little bit on the paranoid side.
And that story, I remember, it was the first time I had heard it in its entirety. Mamaw had told that story to me, but just in pieces. It was almost like she was ashamed of it or something that you just didn't talk about, I imagine, you know, things have happened in your family, that's family linen, you don't take it out of the closet, right?
It's right. Well, and coming from kids, so I always wonder too. So you've got Peg seeing it, and I mean, she might have got stabbed in the arm or leg or something and not been near fatal stabbing. And they would have still, any blood for a kid is like catastrophic, right? So you've got kids' perspective of this woman is stabbed my mom and she's bleeding. She could have bled to death. And traumatic, and how traumatic experiences can be maybe exacerbated in your memory as to what happened. So I'm glad Dad recorded that to hear from their perspective since they witnessed it. But I still have empathy, I guess, or sympathy, both maybe for Aunt Pop, because if you're mentally ill, the world is what you see. You know what I mean? And so you may not be in control of your behavior in that respect because you think something is going on or you think you see something that's going on that maybe isn't fact, but in your world, it is fact.
Yeah.
So the fact that in your essay, you talk about how she made dolls and that seemed to be her like little hobby. I feel like the woman was lonely, you know, she was alone and probably ostracized because of her mental state. Everybody probably knew, although back then they didn't have a diagnosis for it. And the kids would, you know, be scared of her. I don't know if you've heard the story, but when Grandma finally met Ralph Stanley, the bluegrass musician, they had talked about Aunt Pop. And apparently he said, yeah, that's what the parents would tell us. We're going to send you to Aunt Pop if they were misbehaving because they were so scared of her. So you got that. And as a person, as a human, if you don't have anyone and everyone who you do know is afraid of you, mm-hmm. like that's got to be pretty lonely.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's so I feel for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do too now. I do.
Yeah. 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 I think it's easier as an adult because we've been around, you know, especially the nurse. I've been around a lot of mental illness in my patients and it's sad because, as I said, their world for you is whatever they see, even though you know, hey, that's not realistic what you're seeing, but it is to them. It's so, you know, so very, very vivid to them. It's very sad that she lived like that.
Now, do you know anything more about what happened after, you know, the story goes that she hid out in a cave and that Elkanah and his boys found her there, but he didn't kill her. He wanted to. But I'm sure.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Didn't, because she's family, right? She's
right.
Sister-in-law, and you just didn't do that. As I understand it, they didn't get the police involved or anything like that. She just.
I don't believe anything came of it. I don't believe. I mean, I'm sure she was probably more ostracized after that.
Probably.
But no, as far as I know, they did not get the police. Like today's standards, I mean, you almost. That's a crime against the state. So you almost don't have a choice. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you stab your neighbor, you stab your sister. Probably going to get worked up whether your family wants it to or not. But imagine how often that probably happens, that people do keep stuff quiet and on the down low because it's your family. You still love that person, you know, because they're family. You don't want to see bad things come. So how often does that happen, that people just let that kind of thing go? Yeah. And back then, kind of like it is now, I hate to say that there's not a lot of good mental health help. We're definitely better than we were. But it's still a struggle for people to get the mental health help they need for their loved ones.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a system that's very difficult to navigate. So back then, there wasn't much of a system. It was either an institution, which I can see our ancestors saying, no, we're not sending to an institution. Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't even be a thought probably for our ancestors to even consider doing something like that, if there was one available, you know, in the area.
Yeah, because they would have called it, in the vernacular, they would have called it the crazy house, you know. I mean, and I know that's crass, but that growing up, you know, that's what older folks called the place where you were sent. If you know, and they use the term crazy, and I know we don't do that now. Well, that's the stigma, right?
But you're right. They did. When I was growing up, we had one of my grandpa's brothers had married a woman who had schizophrenia. She had a lot of problems and they had two children with schizophrenia. And the oldest was so bad that they put him in a mental hospital, in the state mental hospital in Madison, Indiana. But when they would refer to him, they'd be, oh yeah, he's in Madison. So growing up, I thought Madison was a mental hospital. I didn't realize it was a town until I was an adult. Like I was going to nursing school and they're like, were you going to go to Madison for your clinical? And I'm like, Madison? There's a hospital there too, besides a mental hospital. But growing up, that's how we referred to a mental hospital, was Madison.
Yeah.
That's where everybody went.
I've got one picture of her. I haven't seen any other pictures of her, but it's the picture of her standing in front of the cabin with the bonnet pulled low over her eyes.
Yeah, my mama's had that picture. That's the only one I know of too, that I'm aware of. Yeah, I mean, I think, what else is there to say? She clearly had mental illness. She suffered. She definitely caused some damage.
It's sad that those are the only stories we have about her. We don't know anything about her beyond that.
I would love to have seen the dolls. Like, I bet they were impressive. You know what I mean?
Right.
I bet she was an artist. I bet she created beautiful dolls. And that's sad that that was her companionship.
Legacy.
You know what I mean?
Well, maybe somebody in our family who's related to us will have more information and may reach out.
Yeah.
That's what I always hope, is that things like this connect people.
Yes, definitely.